Carolina Journal is your source for daily news and commentary in North Carolina covering politics and public policy. A project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit and investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of public funds by public officials, including members of Congress and members of the North Carolina General Assembly. In season two of Extreme Injustice, North Carolina students and their families made life-changing sacrifices after state policies shuttered public schools across the state. Our deep dive into the unintended consequences of COVID lockdowns show the desperate need for new thinking in public education. For the past two episodes, we've explored the academic, social, and mental health costs of school shutdowns. So, what about the solutions? To progressives in North Carolina, the solution is seemingly simple: spend more money on traditional public schools. And their way to do this is by fully funding the Leandro Plan. Now, for those who might not be aware, Leandro here in North Carolina is a court case going back to 1994, and it originated when five rural school districts sued the state over education funding. Since then, the state Supreme Court has ruled two times, once in 1997 and again in 2004, that the state of North Carolina has a constitutional obligation to provide a sound basic education to all students. Now, it's been a controversial case, particularly in recent years, when a remedial plan was created by a San Francisco-based consulting firm called WestEd that recommended billions in new spending on public education. More recently, last year, a district court judge ordered the state to transfer $1.7 billion into public school coffers, but the NC Court of Appeals has put a stop to that since then. Ultimately, this case could end up before the North Carolina Supreme Court, and a lot of it, or the central part of it, has to do with whether the judiciary can order the transfer of state funds or whether it's the obligation of the North Carolina General Assembly, which, of course, it is constitutionally. So many observers believe that far more needs to be done than just looking at the Leandro decision to really stem the tide of learning loss, and that's what we're going to explore today. We're also joined today by a special guest, Dr. Terry Stoops, who is director of the Center for Effective Education at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to explore today, obviously, some of the solutions to help students who have experienced learning loss recover from that. And I first want to get your take on this whole issue of the progressives in North Carolina saying, well, just fully fund Leandro and that will everything will be solved. What's kind of your response to that, the Leandro case in general?
Well, this is really the only play that Democrats have right now in trying to get money spent on public education. That in the past, Republicans have been reluctant to write the big checks, and so they're trying to get the courts as a way to leverage the power of the judiciary to get Leandro funded. But here's the real issue here. Here's the real problem with Leandro is that the comprehensive remedial plan that was created by WestEd was created before the pandemic. So the plan that the judiciary is trying to get the General Assembly to fund is not designed for a post-pandemic environment. And so this is going to put them in a real bind here. So are they going to try to get this plan funded, or are they going to go back to the drawing board? And if they do get back to the drawing board, then it will call into question how the plan was developed in the first place, specifically the fact that the plan didn't include any input from the General Assembly.
Sure. Sure. I mean, you know, as a parent with a high school student, nobody's more invested in public education than the parents. And that's basically what it is. And our children have become something of a social experiment, particularly the kids in the older grades who won't have the opportunity to benefit from some 30-year plan. So what do we do right now? Because learning loss is very real. And this argument that I'm hearing that it is something made up, that test scores don't matter, that those do matter, because at the end of the day, when she goes to apply for a career training or apply for a college or whatever, what are they going to ask for? They're going to ask for her test scores. So they do matter.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And the best way to think about it is education is cumulative. It builds on each other. And we have an expected pace that we have students who are in our public schools and private schools to be able to maintain through their academic career. And interruptions to that can really set them back, not only through their education, but when they get into workforce and find that their accumulated skill set from their years in education are not meeting the needs of the employer. And that's why we're seeing studies by mostly international groups find that the impact of the learning loss on the economies, on the world economy, is in the billions and trillions of dollars, because students will be graduating without the requisite skills to be able to be successful in college and career. And so not only are we going to have that economic effect that is down the road, but these children are going to have difficulty when they become adults transitioning into the workplace because they were deprived of the necessary skills and knowledge during those government-mandated lockdowns.
Sure. What about, does that mean that the responsibility of this is going to fall on future employers and universities? Because it's not just college, it's also career training programs who are going to be trying to teach people to maintain our homes, maintain our vehicles without fundamental math skills. And that's a challenge at every level of our economy. Does that mean it's going to fall on the university system to make up what the public school system failed in?
Well, the public school system can respond right now and should respond because they have they're sitting on billions of dollars. The federal government spent hundreds of billions of dollars in COVID relief funding. North Carolina received over $5 billion. Only about $1.5 billion of that has been spent so far. So now is the time to start thinking about how can we use that money in a productive way to ensure that our students are caught up, because we can't trust that once they get to a university that the university is going to do it. We certainly can't put that burden on employers that are already having difficulty finding employees. So the money is there, the time is there, but unfortunately, I don't really see the kind of urgency that we really need to have in our public school system to start attacking this problem. And we don't see a lot of the research-based ideas being advanced for using this COVID relief money. Instead, it's across-the-board bonuses and raises for teachers. We need to start thinking long and hard about the type of programming that's going to be necessary in order to address these gaps in learning. And let's make no mistake about it. North Carolina public schools were struggling before the pandemic, and a large portion of our students were not proficient in reading and math. And now we're at a point where even a larger percentage of North Carolina students are not proficient in reading and math. And so now that we have the money and time to be able to address the problem, we need to sit down and seriously think about how to do so. And there are some people that are doing it, but I find that the lack of urgency on the state and the local level for attacking this problem is really, really disconcerting.
Terry, I wanted to ask you then about some ways forward. And specifically, I know you've talked in the past about the value of having students go through really high dosage kind of intensive tutoring. And I found that very interesting. What would that look like? How would that help with the...
Yeah, we're looking at those students, of course, who would need it the most in small group or one-to-one settings with a high-quality teacher really bearing down on the subject matter at hand and having as much individualized attention to addressing the gaps in learning that are determined through test scores. That's the reason why we have testing, is to identify shortcomings in student learning and then address those shortcomings. And that's why testing is so important. And when you hear people discount it, you have to ask them, what other diagnostic tool are you going to use in order to judge where people are at when it comes to their learning progress? So high dosage tutoring tied to academic content that's happening in the classroom with a high quality teacher is absolutely essential. There are other things that we could be doing, after school and summer programs, again, with high quality teachers. How do we know they're high quality teachers? We use testing to see how their students are performing on these tests to determine whether they're receiving a quality instruction in the classroom. And then this is the one that I don't talk about a lot, but I think is absolutely important. A return to normal. Kids learn best in that environment that they were in before the pandemic. So the closer we can get schools to normal, the better it's going to be for students, both from an academic standpoint and from a mental health standpoint. So, you know, all of the signs, the COVID signs about washing our hands and social distancing, that's on a return to normal. And that gets children thinking about the difficulties they experienced during COVID rather than thinking about what it's going to take to go forward.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I'm seeing almost like a PTSD among some students because they're still surrounded by that culture and frankly, fearful teachers in the classroom who are concerned for their safety. You know, certainly they have the right to wear a mask if they like to, and if other kids want to wear them. But you're right, it is a reminder. Do you feel like you're hearing sort of a tone-deaf approach? You mentioned urgency. What are your thoughts on that?
I would like to hear, especially state education leaders, the State Board of Education specifically. Since the pandemic started, the John Locke Foundation has been asking our State Board of Education to come up with a plan. Give us a roadmap for what schools need to do. They still haven't done it. And these are State Board of Education, it oversees education policy in North Carolina. They're appointed by the governor to very long 8-year terms. And this is the most important governing board for public schools and education. And I feel like they've been asleep at the wheel. Most of what the State Board of Education has done is, on every decision, defer to the Department of Health and Human Services or just urge people to kind of wait and see what happens. Well, that's not good enough. You are the State Board of Education. You are appointed to this position because you are setting the standard for what our public schools need to do. And more than ever, they need guidance on what to do, and they haven't received it. So I find that our State Board of Education in particular has really fallen short of the kind of mandate that taxpayers expect to have for the most important governing board in North Carolina education. Now, fortunately, the Constitution is very clear that the North Carolina General Assembly can tell the State Board of Education to do stuff. The State Board of Education is subject to all the legislative laws and mandates and statutes that are passed into law. So it may require our General Assembly to get our State Board of Education moving in the direction of addressing learning loss in an aggressive, research-based way.
Let's take a quick break. We'll have a lot more coming up, talking here with Terry about education in North Carolina and learning loss for students during COVID.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For 3 decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org.
Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Visit carolinajournal.com to learn more.
Now, Terry, one idea I've heard is that coming out of this pandemic, one of the silver linings has been the explosive growth of school choice broadly, and not just school choices and families making different decisions for themselves, but also more and more people in general are seeing the need for options and seeing the benefits of that, particularly as people were restricted so much during the height of the pandemic with being in one school that just wasn't working for them. So I know another idea that you've brought up for how to kind of counter learning loss is this idea of a specific learning loss ESA. And I'm curious, what would that look like?
In order to get tutoring for students, we need to have sufficient staff. And we're hearing all these rumors about teacher resignations and all of these issues. What I would argue is that our current staffing levels at our public schools will not be sufficient to provide students with the tutoring that they need. So we need to look beyond our public school staff to nonprofits, to for-profit tutoring centers, and allow taxpayer money to be used for tutoring in those environments and not just in a traditional school setting. And so what an ESA would do is to give parents a fund, a small amount of money where they can use it to pay for tutoring services from one of these private tutoring companies, from a retired teacher, from any qualified individual that would be able to provide those services, because this is an all hands-on-deck approach. And we're not going to get it done if we just rely on our traditional public schools to provide the tutoring. We have to use all the resources in our community. And what an ESA would do is allow parents to use that money to access those types of resources outside of the public school. A lot of people say it's a debit card and they could take it and use it in a debit card. Yeah, I guess you can consider it something akin to that. But in its barest form, it is a way to empower parents to allow them to make the decisions that are in the best interest of their child. And we already have ESAs in North Carolina. For special needs children, they can take an education savings account, a very large one, and take it to a private school. They could also use it for tutoring, for therapy, for equipment. This is really customizing education for children. This tutoring ESA would just be a smaller amount, but it would have that same idea in mind. So if a parent wanted to use the money for tutoring, but also wanted to buy some instructional materials for their child, an ESA would allow them to do it. It is absolutely the way forward, not only just in the school choice movement, but if we're really going to think about how we educate individual children, we need to stop sending money to the system, stop sending money to the schools, and we need to start thinking about ways to empower parents, and ESA is the ideal way to do that.
And that would be equitable across the economic spectrum. So kids, right. Families who are struggling the most and might need Wi-Fi and glasses, and well, that might fall under health, but you know, they need some of those very basic materials that could be used for that. And if a kid needed SAT prep at the other end of the spectrum, perhaps it could be used for any of those things.
That's right. And given the scale of need, most likely any ESA that the General Assembly would want to consider would be targeted to the students that need it the most. And so we would probably, rather than see a universal ESA, which I would absolutely love and I think is absolutely needed, they have in the past always favored kind of a targeted approach where they would identify the students that are struggling, perhaps those that are most behind. There are those pesky test scores again telling us where students are. And based on those test scores, perhaps award an ESA, or you can make it a graduated rate where some students get a much larger ESA compared to others that may not get as large an amount because they don't have as much need. Now, the one thing that we did learn from the study that came out for the Department of Public Instruction is that everyone lost ground, including our academically and intellectually gifted students. So we didn't escape anything in North Carolina. Even our most talented, our smartest students lost ground during the pandemic. So the argument that they wouldn't need an ESA, it'd be kind of hard to make that argument, given the kind of...
Yeah, and of course, I'm putting on my sarcasm hat here, but the biggest danger with a ESA, a learning loss ESA, of course, is that we'd actually have to trust parents to make intelligent decisions about what's best for their kids, and we can't have that, right?
right.
That's the danger.
Well, and I think that's an argument, and I know progressives have said, nope, just put more money into the schools, we'll take care of it. And there's a trust problem. And I think that is one of the big issues that I, as a parent, and what I'm seeing is that there's a trust problem. They really love their community school. They love the individual teachers, but they don't trust the system. And that's part of what we're seeing personally in our house and in our neighborhood, is that we love our teachers. They're our neighbors. We love our principal, but we don't trust the system that they are saddled with. And that system is what's failed our children.
And think about this great situation we would have with an ESA is a parent wouldn't have to go through the system in order to get a teacher, that teacher that lives down the street or the teacher of their child, to provide after school or summer tutoring. They could contract directly with that teacher for those services. So you're bypassing having to go through the system. You have teachers that are now entrepreneurs that can use their spare time in order to make money that is going to be put to great use, because it's going to provide individualized instruction for that child without having the hassle of going through the system. So I think not only parents would love this, I think there would be classroom teachers that would jump at the opportunity to contract directly with parents for tutoring services, And an ESA, I think, is the way to go. I do want to say real quick that we polled this in a Civitas poll last year and found that nearly 60%, when we laid out the idea to likely North Carolina voters, favored the idea of a tutoring ESA. So, of course, you know, there's an education component where you have to tell people what an ESA is, because it sounds so foreign to them when they hear, you mean I'm going to get the money and then I get to spend it? Yes. And so we see, when we explain what the concept is, a tremendous amount of support for approaching learning loss using a learning
ESA. Imagine that.
Yeah.
It was January 2022. So it was our most recent school choice poll that we did that shows that voters are enthusiastic about this approach.
Do you think it could be training wheels for a larger program?
Absolutely. And we have already had training wheels with the special needs ESA, which will be expanded in the upcoming school year when it's combined with our voucher program for special needs children. But the great thing about the ESA program for special needs children is that there's an approved list of vendors. There is a agency that's not the Department of Public Instruction that oversees the program. Parents love it. It works well. There are fraud checks in place that ensure that if there is a parent that mistakenly uses the money for a non-approved expense, it gets flagged and then the situation is resolved. We have had experiences in other states where they have had issues like that. We've learned from their experiences. And now we have an ESA program in North Carolina that's virtually fraud-free, that ensures that money is being spent where it needs to be spent. And I think that given our experience with it, we could expand it very easily and provide the kind of services to students that they really need.
Well, thank you very much, Terry, for joining us on the podcast today. This has been a fabulous, wide-ranging discussion with a lot of ideas for how to help students as they recover from learning loss. Tune in next time on the fourth episode of Extreme Injustice, Stolen Time, when we're going to look at the ways that students who have been graduating from high school and transitioning to college, the ways they have been impacted by school closures and the pandemic more broadly, and also some ways that they can be helped as they're just beginning their higher education career and eventually launching out into careers in the world. Extreme Injustice is an investigation series from the Carolina Journal, the media project of the John Locke Foundation. Visit carolinajournal.com today and sign up for our free email newsletter to stay up to date on news from the state capital and how it impacts your business, home, and community. Thank you.